everybody, and welcome to session 321, In Pursuit of the Elusive Joseph Smith. And the presenter today is Dan Vogel, and he's the author of the award-winning biography, Joseph Smith, The Making of a Prophet, as well as many other articles and books on Mormon history. He's an independent researcher and currently lives in Westerville, Ohio. And responding today, we have D. Michael Quinn, and he has a PhD in history from Yale. He is an independent scholar living in Southern California. He just recently finished a year as Beneke Senior Fellow at Yale University and is an affiliated scholar at the University of Southern California Center for Feminist Research. And we're hoping that we may have a few minutes after the respondent for questions and answers, but we will see. And I just want to remind everybody to please turn your cell phones and pagers and any other noisemakers on mute or vibrate or whatever. So.
Thank you. Okay, thanks for coming to this session and daring to be probably the most uncorrelated Mormons around, for you that are out there that are Mormons. Before I begin my paper, I have what I would call a thematic visual appetizer. Okay, so we're going to be talking about Joseph Smith, and my friend Mike Marquardt took me down to Deseret Distribution, and I got a couple of pictures of Joseph Smith. Probably everybody's familiar with this one. Here's Joseph Smith. This, according to Ron Romig, the archivist at the Community of Christ, Joseph Smith III said this was the most like his father, as he recalled the appearance of his father. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to put this out here. Put this right here. All right. Then I have another one. And this is, I got this at Deseret Industries. And this is their current favorite image of Joseph Smith. And put that so you can think about Joseph when I'm talking here. Now, recently I was reading in the newspaper, the Salt Lake Tribune, an article by Piggy Fletcher Stack. And she noticed that there's a Joseph Smith image is a little different nowadays. And she said, as he gets closer to his 200th birthday, Joseph Smith has grown more handsome in modern portraits and files the Mormon church founder's large nose, Napoleonic hairstyle, pardon me, and stout belly have given way to the leaner, tanner look of a California surfer. He seems less remote. This is Peggy still speaking. He seems less remote and more like us. So the questions I might pose by way of introduction is, why do some people feel the need to change the Joseph Smith's image? What purpose do the changes serve? And is historical accuracy important? I also will, kind of as an advertisement for Robert Reese later this afternoon. He'll be talking on Joseph Smith's images in a session at 3:30, seeing Joseph Smith, visual and verbal images of the Mormon prophet. So, the title of my paper is In Pursuit of the Elusive Joseph Smith. If the emotional and spiritual lives of so many were not presently entwined with his story, Joseph Smith would be nothing more than an interesting historical puzzle. But he is more than that. The church is without question Joseph Smith's most enduring legacy, for without it, he would have long since faded into obscurity to join Jemima Wilkinson, Ann Lee, Joseph Dykes, Isaac Bullard, William Miller, and other lesser oracles and failed prophets. Joseph Smith lives through you. And when I say you, I mean the church. So you guys, church members, know who you are. You are therefore part of his story, not simply because you are preservers of his memory, but because you are also co-creators and consumers. While historian Jan Shipps has said, the mystery of Mormonism cannot be solved until we solve the mystery of Joseph Smith, I maintain the mystery of Joseph Smith cannot be solved until we understand better the larger mystery of the attraction of the charismatic leader and the equally mysterious devotion of the true believer. When one understands more fully the symbiosis of the leader and follower, then perhaps Joseph Smith will seem less a puzzle and more like a person trying to fulfill his own needs through his followers. So what I am suggesting is that part of the mystery, part of Joseph Smith's elusiveness, is that we have not paid enough attention to the other half of the equation. Shaman, prophets, heroes, and charismatic leaders are, in important ways, social constructs, because they mirror back to their followers what is demanded of them. Cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker describes this interdependence between leaders and their followers. The qualities of the leader and the problems of the people fit together in a natural symbiosis. People project their problems onto him, which gives him his role and stature. Leaders need followers as much as they are needed by them. The leader projects onto his followers his own inability to stand alone. His own fear of isolation. We must say that if there were no natural leaders possessing the magic of charisma, men would have to invent them, just as leaders must create followers if there are none available. Summarizing Wilfred R. Bion's work in group psychology, Becker further observes that the leader is as much a creature of the group as they are of him, and that he loses his individual distinctiveness by being the leader as they do by being followers. He has no more freedom to be himself than any other member of the group, precisely because he has to be a reflex of their assumptions in order to qualify for leadership in the first place. For this reason, I suspect the real, quote-unquote, Joseph Smith will always remain elusive. So I turn to an examination of his interpreters, those who have struggled to make sense of him, who have ventured to solve what Jan Shipps called the prophet puzzle. There are, in fact, many possible constructions of Joseph Smith. A completely different Joseph Smith, depending on how one assesses the evidence, a completely different Joseph Smith will emerge. But this is exactly as Joseph Smith wanted it. Both as a treasure seer and as a prophet, his claims demanded belief or skepticism. Thus, as stated in the first paragraph of my biography, Joseph Smith has been variously described as a pretender after worldly power, a religious fanatic, or God's mouthpiece on earth. Such strong reaction doubtly stems from Smith's own claims, specifically his declaration that all churches are false and that those who reject the gospel he restored will be damned. For Smith, there was no middle ground, and thus seemingly no middle ground for assessing him or his claims. But I ask, is a middle ground possible or even desirable? Is not the search for a middle ground itself antithetical to the essence of Joseph Smith's personality and message? In his provocative essay, A Joseph Smith for the 21st Century, biographer Richard Bushman worries that the growing tolerance of non-Mormon scholars would bring a blurring of the real issues, and asks, wouldn't believing biographers prefer to have the question of authenticity laid squarely before our readers, even at the cost of having the revelations disputed? Do we want Joseph Smith's challenge to the world to be lost in a haze of patronizing kindness? Obviously, this worry doesn't apply to my writings, but rather to the Academy of Religion, which brackets truth claims for other reasons than patronizing kindness. Scholarship simply lacks the tools necessary to make the kinds of determinations Bush seems to call for. Strictly speaking, scholars cannot answer questions like, was Joseph Smith a true prophet? And is the Book of Mormon inspired of God? However, I would argue that there are more interpretive choices than some in the academy would have us believe. For while Joseph Smith's truth claims are beyond the scope of scholarship, the Book of Mormon's historical status is another matter. I would argue that historians are free to conclude the Book of Mormon is not historical and to revision Joseph Smith's biography accordingly. In other words, a non-historical Book of Mormon presents scholars with a different interpretive paradigm from which to view Joseph Smith. To some apologists, Joseph Smith cannot be a true prophet if the Book of Mormon is not real history, for God and prophets do not engage in deception. BYU professor William J. Hamlin, for example, emphatically states, the issue is this. If the Book of Mormon is fiction, then Joseph Smith could not be a true prophet, a point tacitly accepted by most of those who reject historicity, since all of their accounts include serious equivocation or redefinition of the key concepts of revelation, inspiration, and prophet. A non-historical Book of Mormon might be a serious challenge to some believers, but the consequences of that proposition are not as clear as Hamlin represents. It's not as if these terms haven't already been redefined by apologists themselves to accommodate changes Joseph Smith made in subsequent editions of the Book of Mormon and early revelations, corrections he made in the Bible. Without such equivocation, it would be difficult to explain various historical and literary anachronisms that appear in the Book of Mormon. To accommodate various parallels to the Book of Mormon to the 19th century, many apologists have adopted Blake Osler's theory that Joseph Smith made inspired expansions to the ancient texts. So, in principle, they have already equivocated on fundamental definitions of key terms. Hamlin's dichotomy is therefore false because there is a third and viable alternative even for believers. While the issue of true-false prophet is beyond scholarship, historians can ask such questions as, what was Joseph Smith's definition of prophet? Did he believe God sometimes inspires deception? What was his definition of inspiration? And finally, do Joseph Smith's definitions of these terms exclude a non-historical Book of Mormon? I believe the answer to this last question is no. When Moroni exhorts readers to ask God if these things are not true and promises that he will manifest the truth of it unto you, the text points to a specific kind of truth. Previously, Moroni quoted God as saying, because of my spirit, he shall know that these things are true. For it persuadeth men to do good. And whatsoever thing persuadeth men to do good is of me. For good cometh of none, save it be of me. I am the same that leadeth men to all good. Similarly, Mormon reasoned, I show unto you the way to judge, for everything which inviteth to do good and to persuade to believe in Christ is sent forth by the power and gift of Christ. Wherefore ye may know with a perfect knowledge it is of God. In other words, since all good comes from God, and the Book of Mormon tries to persuade humankind to be righteous and believe in Christ, it is consistent with this line of reasoning that the Book of Mormon is true and inspired, independent of whether, in the final analysis, it is considered historical. This concept of inspiration ties in well with Joseph Smith's definition of prophet. In a letter published in the Elder's Journal in July 1838, Joseph Smith responded to the question, "Do you believe Joseph Smith Jr. to be a prophet?" His answer was yes, and every other man who has the testimony of Jesus. And quoted Revelation 19:10. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. To return to Hamlin's definition, I hypothesize that Joseph Smith believed himself to be an inspired prophet, only not in the way that he led his followers to believe. Thus, I see Joseph Smith as sincere in his claims, but willing to use deception to win souls for God. In my view, he believed his Book of Mormon project to be inspired of God, but he manufactured the plates and manipulated witnesses to increase faith. I also want to challenge the notion that bracketing truth claims requires uncritical acceptance of Joseph Smith's version of events. For the historian, there is simply no justification for privileging Joseph Smith's autobiographies in ways not done for other prominent people. Autobiographies, especially those produced institutionally, are, in the words of British historiographer John Tosh, often inaccurate and selective to the point of distortion, notorious for their errors of recall and their special pleading. Louis Gottschalk's historical primer warns that official histories tend to suppress embarrassing, incriminating, and confidential information and to present apologetic. A critical assessment of Joseph Smith's autobiographies will therefore resist the impulse to harmonize, but highlight changes in detail and emphasis. Attempt to verify details against external sources, seek to reconstruct chronology and uncover anachronisms, take note of events glossed over or suppressed, and listen carefully for apologetic and rhetorical manipulation. The purpose of such an exercise would not necessarily be to raise questions about the veracity of Smith's truth claims, although a non-historical Book of Mormon would entail such issues, but rather as a means of exploring the manner in which he tailored his image to serve the needs of his followers. Apologetic concerns are apparent right from the first lines of Joseph Smith's 1838 autobiography. He begins, well, owing to the many reports which have been put in circulation by evil and designing persons, he began, I have been induced to write this history so as to disabuse the public mind and put all inquirers after truth in possession of the facts. Contrary to this promise, Smith was less than forthcoming when he misrepresented his involvement in money digging as a one-time event in 1825 as one of Josiah Stoll's hired hands. In fact, however, he was a leader in the many such operations over a period of at least 3 years, locating the places to dig with his seer stone, which he never mentioned also. non-Mormon historian Alan Taylor, who charitably referred to Smith's prevarication as a de-emphasis, suggested that Smith recognized that a reputation for treasure-seeking was a handicap in communicating his message to an audience increasingly committed to rationality and a more abstract understanding of religion. Our own beloved Jan Shipps was also charitable when she said, "It seems reasonable to conclude that the motive for playing down this part of the prophet's background was the knowledge that it could be used as a basis for changes that might endanger or charges, pardon me, basis for charges that might endanger his reputation was led." And I ask, how was that life led? I'll use the words of Becker to answer that question, as a reflex of his followers' assumptions. German sociologist Max Weishaupt between followers and charismatic leaders this way: the holder of seizes the task and demands obedience and a following by virtue of his mission. His success determines whether he finds them. His charismatic claims break down if his mission is not recognized by those to whom he feels he has been sent. If they recognize him, he is their master, as long as he knows how to maintain recognition through proving himself. But he does not derive his right from their will in a manner of an election. Rather, the reverse holds. It is the duty of those to whom he addresses his mission to recognize him as their charismatically qualified leader. And so you see, the making of a prophet was and is as much your doing as it was Joseph Smith's. Thank you for listening.
Vogel's paper, In Pursuit of the Elusive Joseph Smith, is interesting on several levels and raises important questions about interpretation and methodology. As a truth in advertising statement, I begin by acknowledging that he and I have discussed several of these issues more than once during our decades of friendship. We remain at odds, even though we agree on elements of the discussion. We have approached this dialogue in the spirit of the Hebrew Bible statement, quote, "Come now and let us reason together," unquote. So today we share this reasoning with an audience. His paper begins with a discussion that is more central to his interpretation than his references to the Book of Mormon, and even more important than what seems to be the central topic of Joseph Smith. The Mormon prophet is only an example of what Vogel calls, quote, "the symbiosis of the leader and follower," and the, quote, "interdependence between leaders and their followers," unquote. The most crucial phrase in his quotes from Ernest Becker is that the leader, quote, "has to be a reflex of their assumptions in order to qualify for leadership in the first place," unquote. Thus, in his Mormon example, Vogel argues that in order to, quote, "fulfill his own needs through his followers," Smith symbiotically tailored his image to serve the needs of his followers, unquote. But the relationship he describes between religious leaders and their followers is a subset of a different dynamic Vogel began exploring decades ago. The introduction to his 2004 Smith biography, The Making of a Prophet, explains, quote, "As a teenager, I dabbled in stage magic and sleight-of-hand tricks, but my attention soon turned to charlatans and confidence men who used similar methods," unquote. Vogel now quotes from sociology, anthropology, and psychology those statements that resonate with his earlier findings about the relationship between confidence men and those they deceive, or con. In a pattern repeated during financial scams and frauds everywhere, including modern Utah, the deceived and defrauded have eagerly believed confidence men or scam artists who told them what these people wanted to hear. It is also commonly reported in newspapers and on television documentaries that the defrauded rush to express defense of the scam artists when their claims are questioned, and sometimes continue this defense even while the fraud is unraveling. I will explain why I call this a different dynamic from the religious context to which Vogel applies it. But he is not alone in regarding religious belief as simply a variation on this larger model of the deceiver and the deceived. Even the Hebrew Bible described this dynamic as people telling the prophets to, quote, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits, unquote. Such religious believers are, as Vogel and others would argue, willing dupes, even eager dupes. And the book of Isaiah demonstrates that this religious pattern extends into the ancient world, probably into prehistory. But I maintain that this model of fraud and defrauded is not the only pattern, either in financial investment or in religious belief. Scam artists thrive because people know that others have actually gotten rich by investing in what seem to be outlandish schemes proposed by a convincing person who did not happen to be a con artist. The best-known example in Western civilization is Queen Isabella, whose trust in the honesty of Columbus and the correctness of his scheme resulted in thousands of tons of gold being shipped to Spain. In religion, the Hebrew Bible was not dismissing all believers as dupes, nor all prophets as frauds, but warning that believers can become religious dupes, either to a good prophet the people have corrupted, or to a fraud whom the people make their religious leader. Vogel acknowledges that there are genuine investments, honest promoters, and well-informed investors as real, quote, unquote, alternatives to financial con games, fraudulent promoters, and deceived investors. However, he does not acknowledge the existence of a, quote, genuine, unquote, version of the relationship between believers and a person claiming to be a visionary or a prophet. Because he does not accept the existence of the metaphysical in any form, Vogel regards anyone making such claims as either delusional or a conscious fraud, and regards anyone believing in metaphysical claims or religious leaders as an ill-informed person or a willing dupe. And if I understand Vogel correctly, he regards as manipulative even the most sincere relationship of a religious leader with believers. I don't think there can be any resolution of that disagreement. A believer in the metaphysical, like me, can acknowledge the existence of both mental delusions and self-serving frauds, while nonetheless affirming the existence of the metaphysical. I think I am being fair in saying that someone who rejects the existence of the metaphysical, like Dan Vogel, cannot acknowledge the existence of even one genuine example of it. Correspondingly, as a believer, I can acknowledge that there are other legitimate and rational interpretations of metaphysical claims, including the absolute denial of their existence. However, I think I am being fair in saying that a naturalistic interpreter like Dan Vogel cannot acknowledge that there exists any other legitimate and rational interpretations of metaphysical claims, especially not the affirmation of such claims. These are fundamental questions about which we must agree to disagree. But I think it is possible that he might agree upon reflection that a major thesis of his paper is flawed, because it is inconsistent with at least some of the historical evidence. This is Vogel's claim that prophets, quote, mirror back to their followers what is demanded of them, unquote, which he restates by quoting Becker's statement that every leader, quote, has to be a reflex of their assumptions, unquote. Throughout his 14 years as president of the New Church, Smith repeatedly did the opposite of what Vogel claims specifically for prophets and what Becker asserts as a generality for leaders. To the contrary, Joseph refused to reflect their expectations of him. Instead, he seemed determined to keep his followers off balance and wondering what he might do next. In December 1830, Smith commanded hundreds of his widely scattered followers throughout New York State to sell their belongings and move to a central gathering place in Ohio. By June 1831, these newly dislocated people were barely settled in or near Kirtland, Ohio, which they believed God had commanded to be their new home. Instead, Smith announced the promised land was not in Ohio, but in Missouri, where the most faithful and righteous should now move. Uprooting his New York followers twice within 6 months and commanding 1,000-mile relocations was certainly not fulfilling their expectations. A year later, his twice relocated followers expected that church headquarters would follow them to Independence, Missouri. Instead, Smith announced in 1832 that God commanded the immediate construction of a temple in Kirtland, which obviously was going to remain church headquarters. During the difficult journey of Zion's camp from Ohio to Missouri in 1834, he preached a Sunday sermon against killing any of God's creatures because even a poisonous snake deserved to live. The next day, as he walked with some of the men who listened to that sermon, Joseph asked to borrow one man's rifle. After shooting a harmless woodchuck, the prophet handed the weapon back to his stunned follower without comment. At church headquarters in Ohio, and later in Illinois, he took positive delight in shocking both new converts and investigating non-Mormons, who commented that he looked like a common man instead of a grand prophet. Instead of flattering them by treating this as a compliment and asserting with obvious humility that prophets were just mortal men, Joseph routinely shocked such persons who expected pious prophets by then inviting them to pull sticks with him or wrestle in the dirt of the city streets. At the new headquarters in Nauvoo, recently arrived converts assured him that they had moved from Michigan to Illinois because they had a testimony that, quote, a prophet is always a prophet, unquote. In Vogel's view, these were eager dupes whose gullibility Joseph should want to encourage. Instead, he contradicted their simple faith, explaining that, quote, a prophet was only a prophet when he was acting as such, unquote. This statement allowed them and his other followers to legitimately question his every act or statement. That hardly seems the approach of a scam artist that a scam artist would use with followers who were willing to be deceived. Also in Nauvoo one Sunday, he spoke about the evils of using tobacco. The next day, he smoked a cigar while riding in his carriage on the city's main street. Can anyone regard such behaviors as supporting Vogel's claim that Joseph Smith, quote, tailored his image to serve the needs and expectations of his followers? Nor does the historical evidence of Smith's leadership support Becker's theoretical model, which, like many social science constructs, does not always fit specific cases. In support of those theoretical models, the last section of Vogel's paper gives examples of what he calls, quote, rhetorical manipulation, prevarication, and useful fiction, unquote, in Smith's official versions of his life. I say versions because Smith dictated his first autobiography in 1832, expanded and revised it in statements recorded only in manuscript during 1834 and 35, further expanded it in statements which Oliver Cowdery officially published in 1834 and 35, began dictating a further expansion and revision in 1838, and from 1840 to 1844 gave both written and verbal versions of parts of his early history. Inevitably, there were differences of emphasis, information included in one version but left out of others, and silence about issues demonstrable from sources external to Smith. I have been on record for many years concerning these misstatements, omissions, deletions, and revisions in these autobiographical processes, and especially about the confusion they have often caused in understanding various developments. But I assess these processes and problems differently than Vogel does. Sanitizing one's autobiography through omission or de-emphasis of potentially embarrassing details is not the same as, quote, a useful fiction, unquote. Such sanitizing deprives the reader or listener of information that may be significant, but most historians cannot accept the claim that an incomplete story is a false story. All history is an incomplete effort to present an infinity of past events and circumstances. In saying this, I am not, quote, privileging Smith's autobiographies in ways not done for other prominent people, unquote. However, Vogel assesses Smith's autobiographies, more harshly than I assess memoirs by both the elite and commoners. For example, paraphrasing without source citation Marvin Hill, Vogel states that, quote, Smith conflated elements from 1820 and 1824 to create a useful fiction, unquote. This is not how most historians view conflation, which is the most common problem in autobiographies and reminiscences. Conflation is not combining an actual event with a fictional event. Autobiographies can typically conflate, in other words, merge two or more actual events from the past. They do so for two reasons. First, due to honest inaccuracies of the person's memory, or second, to streamline the narrative rather than repeating similar events with similar outcomes. I think the latter was the reason Smith's 1838 official history conflated circumstances of Palmyra's Methodist revival in late spring of 1820 and his 1820 vision by combining those circumstances with the circumstances of Palmyra's more impressive revivals of 1824 and their effect on his mother and brother Hiram in joining the Presbyterians. Joseph merged the two revivals, combined two different kinds of family conversions, and dated this conflation as spring of 1820. While this is partially inaccurate, I see it as streamlining his narrative, not as an example of fraudulent invention. For the most part, Dan Vogel and I do not disagree about the evidences. We disagree about their significance and implications. In that respect, we are typical of historians who disagree about many things in the past. Thank you.
So I guess we do have some time for questions, and since there is this one microphone, I believe they've just been restating the question when it's asked to you, and then, okay. So, anyone?
Question and comment from the audience was that it is not necessarily a sign of truthfulness to for a leader, a religious leader in this case, to keep his people off balance. A person could be a fraud and still seek to keep his followers off balance in various ways, if I'm accurately restating that comment. my comment about Joseph Smith's doing this was specifically in reference to the inflexible assessments of Vogel and of Becker, that leaders, in Vogel's case generally, and religious leaders in Vogel's case specifically, must reflect what their leaders, or pardon, their followers expect. And that this is typically the approach of con artists, that con artists will say things, and scam artists will say things and say everything to reinforce the expectations of the conned, of the deceived, to tell them what they want to hear and tell it over and over again. That's a typical approach. Joseph Smith didn't follow that approach, and I gave the examples of it, and particularly by challenging people who, from Vogel's point of view, were eager to be deceived, who believed that a prophet is always a prophet, which would put a carte blanche on anything Joseph Smith said or did. Joseph Smith countered that willingness to be deceived with a caution, that a prophet is only a prophet when he's acting as such, undermining their unilateral, unequivocal statement of faith in what he said and did. This, to me, is not the behavior of somebody who is trying to deceive, to create legitimate reasons for discounting what you say or do. That was my argument. It does go counter to what Vogel and Becker both say, in both specific and general.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank Mike for responding to my paper. We have like probably 20 years together as friends, and we've disagreed in a friendly manner, and that we have different interpretations of things, and we allow each other to have our space. So, and I think that's my relationship with him over the years has been very beneficial. I need to hear the other side of the opinions also. But it's very apparent that we have different perspectives. I don't think there's any denial that Joseph Smith, that there's a transition in Joseph Smith's image in the texts and testimonies from the early period to the later period, that he repressed a certain, his money-digging image, and seer stones and guardian treasure spirits and things like that, and that his image became more and more of a prophetic image. And the money-digging image fit a lot of the followers he had in New York and the expectations that they had. So when he transformed his image, he became more appealing and to a larger, more Christian-oriented audience. And that I think is undeniable. That you can find his behavior being inconsistent with a purist view that he always in every circumstance lived up to the people's expectations would be kind of along the lines of a fallacy. Of the exceptional cases. You know, it's like there could never be any generalizations made if there's always, because you're always going to find an exception. But does the exceptional case disprove the general principle? I don't believe it does. I'll have to agree to disagree with my good friend Mike Quinn on that matter. Any other questions? Sorry. I don't disagree that there's a phenomenology of metaphysics, that there are spiritual experiences. I have spiritual experiences too, you know. But I have a different interpretation of where they come from and how much authority we should give those experiences. I believe that they're important sources of information that come from the perhaps the lower part of the brain known as the limbic system, and that we should have a balance between the reason and the sources of information that come from those other areas. So my interpretation is different. And I believe that those experiences that we have from that area of the brain are social constructs. That when we have those experiences, we impose our social construct onto that experience and imply all sorts of things that might not be a necessary element of those experiences. Oh, and one comment I need to make real fast is that I cannot deny that, and I state this in the introduction to my biography, I don't claim that the supernatural does not exist, okay? Because that's an impossibility. I mean, you can't prove a negative, okay? What I do claim is that the evidence upon which such claims rest, so far as I've seen them thus far, are not convincing to me. Okay, I'm not persuaded by the various evidences of remote viewing or psychic readings, these type of experiences. But I don't deny, like I said, that there's a spiritual, what we would call a spiritual dimension to our lives. I have a different interpretation of what it means. More physical. Sir?
Mike mentioned that Joseph Smith has been quoted as saying things that sounded quite reasonable and liberal, not always acting like a prophet. But was his behavior congruent with that? If he was challenged, was he willing to take those challenges, or did he not do that?
Early in his career, he made all sorts of claims of being, the churches were false, not because they didn't have the Melchizedek priesthood or something, but because they didn't have the Spirit, and they didn't have the Spirit because they were hypocrites. And so he was kind of putting himself up as, a little holier than thou. But he was young and kind of reckless, I guess. But as the people got to know him, he didn't quite live up to that image of a prophet. He couldn't live up to that. So I believe the statement that he made, that a prophet's only a prophet when acting as such, and his other behavior was to tell his followers that he was just human, because it became very apparent really fast that he could not live up to that image of a Nephi or a Moroni or, the great prophets that he wrote about in the Book of Mormon. So the statement came about from necessity, I've argued for many years that he shifted from a more charismatically based authority, which does rest on this notion of being pure and worthy of the Spirit, and having the Spirit means that you have the authority of God, to an office or institutional based authority, and all that was very necessary from a sociological perspective. He learned things as he went along also, and that he would do such acts contrary would be a method of desensitizing his followers to the fact that he was more human than they expected. Sir?
Reflecting on the symbiosis between leader and follower and going to the non-root period, it seems to me that Joseph Smith kind of created a minefield. He had introduced many of his devoted followers into the practice, yet he never once publicly admitted the practice. And of course, it was a big factor in the Nauvoo Expositor incident, which caused the volcano of anger to erupt within Hancock County. Do either of you know of any case where Joseph Smith confided to anybody any worries or fears that he had about this minefield that he had created, saying one thing publicly and doing something else privately?
And can you repeat that for the faith?
The question deals with polygamy and if Joseph Smith ever confided that there was a contradiction between the public statements he made denying polygamy and the actual fact that he was living polygamy. Are you talking about a public confession?
Yes.
Dan's restated the question. The answer I'm aware of is that William Marx, who was president of the Nauvoo stake, said that shortly before Joseph Smith's death, Joseph spoke with him, knowing that he was an opponent of the plural marriages that Joseph Smith was secretly engaged in and teaching to others. And Marx said that Joseph Smith told him that polygamy was going to destroy the church, and that he was prepared to abandon it. And I discuss this in the Mormon Hierarchy Origins of Power as one example of a series of retreats that Joseph Smith made in the last days of his life. Now, Marx dates this as much earlier than the last few days. I think that may have been an error in dating on his part, because it's more consistent with what Joseph Smith was saying and doing with respect to other issues of revolutionary developments that he had introduced into Mormonism. And those were clearly things that he said within the last few days of his life. But the time being an issue we could put on a shelf, Marx did state the very thing that you specified, that Joseph Smith confided, that things were at a level that the church could be destroyed by the secret practice of polygamy, which was being publicly denied, and that this could not continue as it was without there being an explosion. And of course, the explosion occurred, and it was a series of explosions. I mean, you have basically decades of explosions in Utah once Brigham Young announced the practice publicly, and that was in 1852, and for the next 40 years, there were a whole series of explosions which came close to destroying the LDS Church.
Sir? I have understood it the way you understand it. I'll never understand the metaphysical the way he does, because he's a follower, and that that is the key to understanding Joseph Smith. Not the other way. Jan Shipp said the mystery of the Book of Mormon Mormonism won't be solved until we solve the mystery of Joseph Smith. And I said, the mystery of Joseph Smith won't be solved until we understand the followers. Okay? Because there's a symbiosis. And I don't think that it's possible to deny the symbiosis. But I want to address a question on the first vision that Mike brought up, actually. The point I was making about the first vision wasn't whether there was a revival or not a revival. It's kind of a red herring, in my opinion. Started with the debates between Reverend Walters and some of the apologists, and they're kind of stuck in that mode. They don't want to give up the idea that even though they're admitting that there's a conflation of the 1824 elements being brought into the 1820 period. The point I was making was that the revival, or actually the words that Joe Smith used, was an unusual excitement on the subject of religion, which resulted in the conversions of his mother and three older siblings, actually occurred in 1824. And Joe Smith put those back to 1820 before, and so that they would, those elements would precede his vision. And he portrays himself in 1820 as being confused about which church is true. That is what I'm really saying is an anachronism, because in his 1832 history, he says that he has already concluded that all the churches are false and from reading the Bible. So he has no question. He's not concerned about which church is true in 1818. He's already decided that. In 1820, he's already decided, still decided. And he has a vision in which Jesus appears. And the question posed to Jesus, there was no question posed to Jesus of which church is true, because he's not worried about that. In 1838 account, the which church is true question comes in, is interjected into the story in an anachronistic way. And part of that, I argue, is because the elements that he's projecting back, the revival, where his mother joined the church, and his mother joined the church, split the family over the subject of religion. The implication being that Joseph Smith Sr.'s dreams don't have as much authority with Lucy as probably Joseph Smith Sr. would like, and that another volatile issue was the fate of Alvin, because the minister, Presbyterian minister, implied that he had gone to hell. At that, in 1824, which church is true is very important to Joseph Smith all of a sudden. It's a family issue, it's a volatile issue, and solving that becomes a very important thing. So I am arguing that not only the revival of 1824 is anachronistic, but the question of which church is true is anachronistic, and that the answer to that question, which was a prophetic kind of calling, that none of the churches are true. In the 1838 account, there's a parenthetical statement that says, and I had, no sooner as I got to myself, hold of myself, that I asked which church is true, for it never entered into my heart that they were all wrong, which is a direct contradiction of the 1832 account. And in the Wentworth letter, it adds that Jesus told, you know, that all the churches were false, to join none of them, and that that he has a work for Joseph to do. So that it changed the whole nature of the first vision story from a personal account of forgiveness of sins to one that which church is true, and he's called to do a further work dealing with that matter. It changes the vision into a prophetic call, which Joseph Smith had no inkling of an idea in 1820. So to me, it's very clear that he's manufacturing an image of a prophet that suits the situation. Like, when you study any history, any text, it's not really about the past that they're reminiscing about. It's more about the political situation needs of the readers, the potential readers that are going to read the 1838 account, that need to be taken into account when you're analyzing why certain things are being said. Thank you.
I think if you were to ask Susan Easton Black how she responds to my comments, you might have a different perspective. Susan Easton Black wrote a book that I think is perhaps one-fifth the size of Dan's.